an issue with the, you know, with the proposals, I don't think.
Good afternoon. I'd like to bring to order the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Efficiency for the 2013 Legislative Assembly. And we're going to start out with introduction of committee members. Today's date is Tuesday, February 5th, 2013. And I think we will start to my right. Representative, if you'd like to introduce yourself and let people know a little bit where you come from and what brought you here.
Sure. Thank you, Chair. I am Representative Jessica Vega Peterson from East Portland in District 47. Happy to be here.
Representative Kim Thatcher from Kaiser, representing the area up to Newburgh. Not Salem, but up to Newburgh.
You're introducing yourself right now.
I'm Representative Margaret Doherty, House District 35, Tigard and Southwest Portland. Got here just in time, too.
Dennis Richardson. I represent parts of Southern Oregon. It's District 4, and it's West Medford across the Rogue Valley to areas around Grants Pass.
I'm John Lively. I represent District 12, which is essentially the city of Springfield.
And I'm Representative Greg Smith. I represent District 57, which is the Eastern Oregon Columbia River District, going from Milton Freewater all the way down the Columbia River to Dufour in Wasco County.
If you come further west from Representative Smith's district, you come to Hood River, where I live, and represent House District 52, which is all of Hood River County, that part of Clackamas County that goes from basically government camp down Highway 26 to Gresham, and then comes back up the Columbia River Gorge through Corbett and Cascade Locks and all that beautiful area. Happy to be here.
And I'm Representative Paul Holby. I represent District 8, which is South Eugene and South Central Lane County, including Lorraine, Crow, Bonita, Elmira, Notai, Walton, and Elvador. And with that, welcome committee members. And we're going to start out today by adopting the committee rules. I hope everyone has had a chance to look at those rules, and it's similar to rules that you've seen in other committees, or probably exactly the same as rules you've seen in other committees. And I just wanted Bob to point out a couple things that are actually changes in the rules for this session.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, as Chair Holvey said, the rules are largely similar to what you've seen in previous regular sessions, but you'll note the slight change to the rule about minority reports, a clarification of timeline. I'm referring to item 16B, the words "of said measure" that have been added. Essentially, the change requires that any issue to be included in a minority report have been raised during discussion, during committee discussion of the underlying measure. The other significant change, you'll note that Rule 17 is a new rule which requires members in committee to announce potential or actual conflicts of interest prior to the committee vote on a measure, and then to provide a written statement to committee staff the day after, by 5 p.m. of the next business day after the committee vote, a written statement regarding that conflict of interest.
So with that, I'll move to my Vice Chair, Representative Lively, to give me a motion.
Chair Holby, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated February 5th, 2013.
Representative Lively moves to adopt the proposed committee rules dated February 5th, 2013. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, we move to adopt the proposed committee rules. And they are so adopted. Right now, I'd like to open a work session for the possible introduction of committee measures.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Chair Hovey, I move that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. LC 308 dated 6-18-2012, LC 313 dated 12-13-2012, LC 1079 dated 10-26-2012, LC 1489 dated 11-30-2012, LC 1727 dated 1-30-2013, LC 2006 dated 1-24-2013, LC 2214 dated 10-10-2012, LC 2716 dated 1-14-2013, LC 2946 dated 2-4-2013, LC 2969 dated 2-1-2013, and LC 3430 dated 1-30-2013.
Representative Lively moves that the following LC bills be introduced as committee bills. LC 308 dated 6-18-2012, LC 313 dated 12-13-2012, LC 1079 dated 10-26-2012, LC 1489 dated 11-30-2012, LC 1727 dated 1-30-2013, LC 2006 dated 1-24-2013, LC 2214 dated 10-10-2012, LC 2716 dated 1-14-2013, LC 2946 dated 2-4-2013, LC 2969 dated 2-1-2013, LC 4-30 dated 1-30-2013. Committee members, the introduction of these bills does not portray or tend to any way construe that any member on this committee supports said measure. These are simply to allow a bill to be introduced for possible conversation and consideration. With that, is there any other discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection to introducing the bills? Seeing no objection, the bills are introduced as committee bills. And with that, I'll close the work session for the introduction of committee measures. And we also have one more member who hasn't introduced herself.
Hi, I'm Alyssa Kenny-Dyer. I represent House District 46, which is parts of Southeast and Northeast Portland. It's my first time on this committee.
Welcome. And our committee staff, I'd like them to introduce themselves as well.
Mr. Chair, Bob Esterbrook, Administrator for this great committee. I've been around the Capitol for a few sessions now, but this is my first time as a committee administrator, so I'm very excited to be working with all of our members here.
And Samantha?
I'm Samantha White. I go by Sam. This is my first session, and I'm the assistant for this committee, and I'm very excited to be here.
Well, welcome. I'm sure you'll find this committee interesting and boring and exciting. So with that, I would like to open an informational meeting for this committee. And committee, we're going to have some agencies come up and talk to us about their role in state government and largely how it pertains to this committee. And the first one up we have on our agenda is from the Department of Consumer and Business Services, Pat Allen. And he will be joined by no one at this point. But welcome, Mr. Allen. I'm glad you were able to take the time to be here yourself to give us a little overview. So
thanks very much.
Begin at your leisure.
Thanks very much, Mr. Chair. I'll try to cover interesting, boring, and exciting all by myself here. My name is Pat Allen. I'm the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, which is the state's largest Business Regulatory and Consumer Protection Agency. Our mission is to protect consumers and workers in Oregon while supporting a positive business climate in the state. For the two or three of you who are also on the Business and Labor Committee, you'll probably be happy to know I'm not doing a revisit of that presentation where I really kind of talked structurally about how the agency functions and its divisions and what we cover. I'm happy to come back if you decide that's a topic you'd like to cover some. But I thought today, based on the chair's interest, what I'd try to do really is talk about the agency's approach to consumer protection particularly and talk about how we do that, how we can carry out that mission, how we're structured, the authority that we have, some of the authority that we don't have, and kind of try to distinguish what we do from what you might think we might do or what consumers might think we might do. And really, kind of try to give you that sort of a flavor. You're going to hear today also from Department of Justice, and I particularly want to highlight a little bit how we've got a really rather different structural charge than they do. You'll hear, I'm sure, from the Attorney General about the Unfair Trade Practices Act. Much of what the Department of Justice is able to focus on are certain kinds of activities, no matter who does them, that are defined as poor practices, unfair to consumers, bad acts, however you want to phrase it. In the main, what we're given typically are definitions of certain kinds of people engaged in a particular activity, and we're given the charge to go regulate those populations, and I'll go into some detail on that, for either things that you have defined as bad activities or things you've given me authority to establish a rule of commonly some combination of both. For us, licensing individuals and businesses becomes a very, very common denominator across those bodies for the very simple reason that we're entirely another funds agency. We're funded entirely by fees paid by those whom we regulate. And when you think about that in terms of creating a regulatory program, if there's some kind of a business activity that you want to go regulate and you need to think about how to pay for it, historically, what you have done is to say, well, let's take people who do this, define that as something that needs a license, task DCBS with issuing that license and collecting a fee and then using that fee revenue to pay for that regulatory activity. That's fairly simple and straightforward, but it has some pretty important implications about how you think about consumer protection as we go through. And again, I'll try to hit on that in some particular areas. Last thing before I talk about some specific regulatory areas, just our approach to how we deal with consumer protection, and I did talk about this a little bit at Business and Labor yesterday. We believe that one of the most powerful consumer protection tools is a vigorous competitive market with lots of players competing for consumers' dollars, whether it's in terms of price or service or quality of goods and services. Having a place where a number of businesses are after your dollar is good for you because it helps create a better environment. And so when we talk about our mission being protecting consumers and workers while supporting a positive business climate, that while supporting a positive business climate for us isn't sort of an afterthought of, oh, by the way, be sure you don't, you know, do dumb things. It really is, how do we make sure for whatever areas we're regulating, Oregon is an attractive place to do business so that we have lots of businesses in that sector, whatever it is, trying to do business. An example, again, that I used yesterday is health insurance. The American Medical Association did an assessment late last year that found Oregon has the most competitive health insurance market in the country, and we think that's good for a whole bunch of reasons. One of the reasons is when you look at health insurance, a factor that is important is what's called the medical loss ratio. That's a fancy phrase for how much of your premium dollar goes to pay for health care versus paying for marketing or those kinds of things. And Oregon has amongst the highest rates in the country of your health insurance dollar that pays for health care. That's a good outcome, and we think Oregon being a place where lots of companies want to sell health insurance is a contributor to that. One of the things you should have gotten electronically, and I think there are also paper copies available, is a document that looks like this, which is nothing more than a list of over 30 specific things that you have charged us with doing in consumer protection. And don't worry, I'm not going to go through all 30 items in painful detail one by one. But what I want to, I'm going to talk about a few of them to illustrate some points. But one of the points I want to make is we get that authority from you in those 30 narrow slices. You don't give us authority that says, go protect consumers or go look at financial services and make sure that people aren't being taken advantage of in financial services. You give us very specific authority about specific areas in those financial services, and you tell us who to go regulate, and you tell us frequently with some fairly significant specificity how to go regulate them. And so that list of 30 things is a real different set of charges than some kind of a broad statutory mission to go find bad and take care of it. And we'll see how that plays out in some of these areas. I want to start first by talking about insurance. Insurance is an area, unlike some others, where the state is largely responsible for regulating insurance. There's not some kind of a shared federal regulatory overlay as there is in some of these other areas. We do work through an organization called the National Association of Insurance Commissioners to achieve some uniformity across state lines as we look at how we regulate insurance. There are about 1,300 insurance companies authorized to do business in the state of Oregon. Almost none of them are based in Oregon. Most of them are based elsewhere. And so that notion of an insurance company based in Washington or California or Connecticut or wherever they might be, being held by that regulator to some kind of set of standards that we know about and have worked with the regulators in those states to try to come to some agreement about is really important. Well, the program that I want to highlight here, though, is the Insurance Consumer Advocacy Program. This is an area where we pay for this function by assessments on insurance companies and by fees paid for by what they like to call producers, what we think of as insurance agents. Insurance agents get licenses to be able to sell insurance in the state. The companies get a license to be able to do business in the state. And those fees pay for a variety of programs, including the Insurance Consumer Advocates. This is a group of folks who basically field phone calls from Oregonians who are having some kind of a challenge with their insurance company. And that can range anywhere from a claim that was denied that they think shouldn't have been to some issue around poor customer service, their car. You've all probably dealt with these kinds of issues or have family or friends who have, they totaled my car and the dollar amount isn't nearly what I thought it should have been. They won't pay for this treatment because it's experimental and I think it should be covered. Those kinds of issues. And they take these calls, and these are basically one-by-one retail consumer calls, and they each get work. This is a circumstance where each person deals with a live human being in our office who tries to work to resolve their problem. In the large majority of those cases, there's not really a regulatory issue there when you scratch down into it. There's not a clear-cut case where a company has broken the law. But what there often is an opportunity to work with that consumer to help their company identify some piece of information that they hadn't identified before, figure out some place where there's a judgment call that could be made so that someone can take a look at it, and basically just try to work on how to help that consumer and that insurance company find a resolution to a situation that that's causing that friction at that time. We do, out of that unit, though, refer to our enforcement unit circumstances where we think there is actual bad activity, where a company has got a provision in its policy that's not allowed or an agent has engaged in some activity that they're not allowed to. So we do generate enforcement work, but mostly it's just helping consumers work out problems with their insurance company. In a couple of to highlight in banks and in the finance section, banks, trusts, credit unions, this is an area where, unlike insurance, where the state has sole responsibility, we share responsibility with the federal government. We share that a little bit differently depending on which agency and how it's chartered. Banks and credit unions have what's called a charter, a license to operate, that they get either from the state government or the federal government, and they're regulated by whoever grants that charter. Additionally, they have deposit insurance. In the case of credit unions, deposit insurance comes from National Credit Union Administration, FDIC, in the case of banks. But there are always two regulators involved, the insurance regulator and the charter regulator. In Oregon, we have 28 state chartered banks. That's down as we came through the economic crisis, partly due to failure of a handful of banks. And now we're seeing a wave of consolidation in the industry where banks are being purchased for business reasons, for structural reasons, for risk reasons. We have 18 state chartered credit unions in the state. A little bit different circumstance in banks. Mostly smaller local banks tend to have a state charter, and large multi-state or large in-state operations have a national charter. Credit unions, almost the exact opposite. The small single business credit unions often have a federal charter. Larger operations tend to have a state charter. But again, the bottom line line there is that that we share responsibility with the federal government. We're really looking at two sets of issues there to protect consumers. One is the behavior of businesses in terms of how they deal with consumers. But the second, and I would say more significant, is financial safety and soundness. Our primary mission, and this is a mission that's existed since the Great Depression, is to make sure that that those institutions where people's deposits are kept are at relatively less risk of going under. And so we audit and assess and monitor those institutions to make sure that they're being operated in a safe and sound manner so that we don't have failures that result in pressures on deposit insurance or back at the time before that runs on the bank, because that's bad. That's bad for the economy. We want people to be confident in those institutions and keep their money there. I want to talk about another one quickly, just because it's so narrow. We regulate, by your authority, debt collection agencies. The interesting thing to me is you've not charged us with dealing with how debt collection agencies collect debt. You've actually charged Department of Justice with that. What you've charged us with is protecting businesses from being taken advantage of by debt collectors who are doing something illegal with respect to how they deal with the business, what they pay the share of the debt that they collect from the business, how the business element of the regulation goes. And that's, when I talk about narrow slices, that's a really narrow slice. And there's not a lot of activity that goes on in this program because that's such a small market, but it's an example of how very specifically we can be directed by as you look at this list of programs. Similarly, I've highlighted the Oregon Identity Theft Protection Act. We're not really responsible for identity theft protection as a general topic. What you've given us is very narrow authority to gather reports from entities that have some kind of a breach where they've revealed protected information. We then have a role to examine the procedures in place in that business to prevent those kinds of breaches and the response the business took, business or public agency, because that happens there as well. What was done in response to the breach to see if it was adequate, and we're able to assess fines and ask for corrective action and those sorts of things. But it's really an after-the-fact authority you've given us to look at what happened and see if things need to change, not ongoing responsibility for how that topic gets dealt with. In building safety, you've charged us with a number of consumer protection functions that range from amusement rides on the fairly small scale to boilers and pressure vessels, which are effectively a controlled bomb in the basement of a building somewhere, and things all the way in between. In this area, you've tasked us with sharing that responsibility with seven boards and commissions who were appointed by the governor, confirmed by the Senate, and in varying degrees, depending on which of those boards, we share authority. So typically, licensing standards and requirements to, for instance, become an electrician or a plumber, those boards largely set standards of what the codes are. We work together, so I, as the director, and the boards together need to agree on changes that get made. In all of these cases, what we're trying to do is establish minimum standards of construction safety so that when something gets built, irrespective of where it gets built in the state, residents, occupants, kids in school are able to rely on that standard in those buildings. Here, when we look at enforcement, and this is a theme that you'll find throughout, but I particularly want to talk about it in building safety, we'll come across a circumstance, say, where unlicensed electrical work gets done, and we've got tools, certainly, to go punish that person for doing that unlicensed work, but a big piece of what we try to do is make sure that that person who engaged in that activity arranges for an actual licensed electrician to go back and fix whatever got done that wasn't done to code, or look at it to make sure that it's not going to cause a problem for that consumer. So it's that idea of trying to make things whole again after there's been some sort of an issue. Our actual authority to do that in the agency is a little bit spotty. We don't have very many of our programs that have explicit actual corrective authority where we can order somebody in the absence of anything else to go correct something. Usually what we try to do is, in working to settle some kind of a violation, negotiate that kind of a circumstance as a part of the settlement that we're trying to achieve. I'm sorry, there was one other I meant to touch on. Again, sort of a shared responsibility, and I'll stop and see if there are questions. Under financial services, you'll see, of all things, prearranged funeral products and services. This is another area of shared responsibility. This is the notion of going into a funeral home and prepaying for funeral services, and you give them money. There are standards of how they need to keep that money in terms of escrow and an account that's preserved so that it's there at some point in the future when it needs to be drawn on. The piece of that we regulate is not how those products are sold or how they're delivered or anything like that. That's shared. That's the Mortuary and Cemetery Board that does all of that regulation. We regulate the fund itself and how it's maintained and accounted for, and we maintain basically a backup fund that those providers pay into that is available to make good on those claims if one of those providers goes under, which did happen about 3 years ago, and that fund has, in the last session, was recapitalized through increase in the assessment. So again, another different shared model of who's responsible for how we regulate things. I've covered a bunch of ground, but tried to give you some idea of how you give us consumer protection authority in fairly discrete slices, and those slices push us in directions of how we do or don't respond to particular areas. I'd be happy to answer specific questions you came in here with or might have occurred to you listening to that.
Thank you, Mr. Allen. Questions from the committee? Representative.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you tell me how many staff you have, what your budget is, and just in general how your agency compares to other states in terms of how you operate business? Are you pretty similar? Is there a great variety?
Sure. The agency is just over 900 employees with an operating budget of about $225 million. This is the big structural piece that I did at Business and Labor yesterday, but we cover everything from the work. About half of that budget is the worker safety system. So it's Oregon OSHA, the Workers' Compensation Division, Workers' Compensation Board, which deal with keeping workers safe and healthy on the job and dealing with what happens if something happened that they did become injured or sick, how to get them medical treatment, how to get them income replacement when we can't get them back to work. As well as insurance, finance, building safety, those functions. It's really difficult as an overall agency to compare us to other states because no state really puts these functions together in quite the same way. If we looked at how we discreetly do the individual functions, I'd say in some areas we're very similar, in other areas we're quite different. I think in insurance and finance, our insurance and finance functions look pretty much like those same kinds of functions in other states. Building safety, we have a very different model in Oregon. We're one of a small handful of states that has a single statewide building code. A local jurisdiction can neither go below it nor above it. But the services are delivered through 130 cities and counties that have local building programs. So our role there is basically establishing the construction standards, administering a system delivered by others, and then some small areas where we actually do our own inspections, boilers, elevators, specialized equipment like that. Our worker safety system is reasonably unique. As a result, it's used often as a model in other states for how to try to deliver worker safety and worker compensation benefits in a way that's cost effective. I can do a whole long presentation on changes in the worker compensation system, worker safety system in Oregon over the last 20 or more years that took a system that was very high cost that provided fairly poor benefits and turned it into almost the exact opposite, one of the lowest cost systems in the country that provides good benefits. And so we really look different in that area as well. A really long-winded answer, I'm sorry.
Other questions? Representative Richardson, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if you can be on me or not. Director Allen, I have a question about what you'd said at the very beginning about the funding of the organization comes from the fees that are charged of those over whom you regulate or mm-hmm. that you exercise your power. I remember in mortgage lending during the heyday, you know, in the mid-2006, 7, 8, and early 8, there was a time we had thousands of mortgage brokers and they all paid in their registration fees. After the mortgage collapse, the financial market collapse, my understanding is that number went by, like it dropped by half, and the attempt then was to double the fees that were going to be charged of those that are remaining. The question was, what if it drops by half again? You're going to quadruple it? In other words, if your agency controls the level of investigation and regulation you're going to do, is there not a problem with trying to promote good business when the entire cost of that is placed on those who have no control over those decisions?
Yeah, Chair Holvey, Representative Richardson, that's a great question. It's a little bit, I was going to say philosophical. It might actually rise to theological. I'm not sure.
God only knows.
And he's not sharing. I think you're on one level. Obviously, you're right. On the other level, the question is: well, if you're not going to do it the way we do it now, by charging that regulatory expense to those we regulate, how would you do it? I suppose there are a number of things that we could do that we fund through general that could be funded through general fund. I wouldn't want to try to stack up a lot of those things in a session or any session where you're trying to deal with the demands on those funds. I will say there are a couple of areas like workers' compensation insurance where it's actually not quite accurate to say we charge those who we regulate. In the workers' safety system, we actually are charging what's called the workers' compensation premium assessment, a tax on workers' compensation insurance premiums. And so that's rather broader. That covers people who work and the insurance that pays for that. So there are some areas where we can go a little bit broader. When you go back to these really narrow slices like mortgage lenders, I think that the challenge you run squarely into is if someone wants to come and create a regulatory program and you aren't going to charge those who you're regulating, you're going to look at somebody else who you're not regulating and try to get resources from them. And that, I think, historically has been politically pretty difficult.
Mr. Chair, I would just suggest that we need to be aware of this dilemma that we're placing the agency in, because they have a requirement to perform safe and complete investigation and oversight, but if the only place that they can look for funding is to the small slice, this group that are being regulated, then often it becomes a tremendous burden. It has nothing to, the cost no longer is reflected with what the industry is or how much the person makes or that. It's just, we need this kind of money, so we're going to quadruple the fees. And so if government wants to have certain levels of regulation, then it seems to me that we may want to determine what would be a fair fee, and then if it goes beyond that, then that becomes a responsibility of government. But we really do place your agency in a difficult position.
If I could just add, as you say that, I didn't really touch on it, but when you create each of these narrow slices of regulatory authority and say, go license somebody, what you typically also do is to say, and don't use that money for something else. Right, if you're going to collect it from mortgage lenders, you use it to regulate mortgage lenders, and if you don't use it for that, that's fine, but don't use it for check cashers, or where it really becomes much more of an issue is in building codes. You can collect that money from electricians, but you can't use it to regulate plumbers or use it to regulate people who are doing structural work on a house, right? And it's that issue exactly. If we have a problem that balloons up in one of those narrow slices and goes beyond the resources that are in that slice, we don't have typically the ability to look at other slices to figure out how they might be able to help.
Thank you. I wasn't sure, but it sounded like Representative Richardson was alluding to a concept of having DCBS be other than other funds agency.
If necessary.
Interesting. Appreciate that. Any other questions? Representative Lively?
Sure, and I appreciate your presentation. I have a question around the building safety. So having worked years in economic development, the things I hear from businesses in many cases is so many different levels of regulation, who really is kind of the decider or the bottom line for this. And you talked something about if there was an issue, your involvement would be trying to work towards a solution. So I'm assuming in that case, so if there's a problem, the stop work comes from the local community, your partner in the local community, I assume.
Typically.
So then how does the process work after that point? Because what happens is you shut, the project is shut down. And so your involvement in it at that point is?
Yeah, a couple of things, Chair Holvey, Representative Lively. Two ways to come at that. Ultimately, we have at the state level final code adoption authority. So if there's an argument at the local level between a building official or somebody else within a city or county that they think the code means this and the builder says, no, I think it means that, there is an actual formal process that they can go through to elevate that to us, and the code chief for the appropriate section will look at the circumstances and make a decision, and that decision is binding. There's also the ability, both at the state and local level, to do what are called alternate method decisions, where we can basically look and say, even though usually it says this, if the circumstances are like this and it, you know, it's looked and shaped like this, you can also do this alternate method of complying with the code, and that becomes a fairly important tool for us in trying to resolve those sorts of issues. Where you started out talking about multiple decision makers, one of the things that we've done to try to alleviate that, I talked about 130 cities and counties making building code decisions, and in some parts of the state they actually get kind of thick around each other. I tend to use Clackamas County as an example, where you've got cities and counties and unincorporated areas, and it may well be that the county is going to give you your electrical permit, but the city is going to do your structural permit, and it varies. We've created a first of its kind in the country online building permit system that we're rolling out throughout jurisdictions in Oregon that creates one spot online where a builder can submit their plans, pay their fees. They don't actually even need to figure out which jurisdiction it is that on their own that issues the permits. We're able to walk them through that process and try to significantly make getting building permits easier. And one of the interesting things we found when we rolled out a fairly simple version of this is that as we bring a city or county up, permit volume would go up, not because there was a lot more activity, but because getting a permit was all of a sudden a lot easier, and frankly people who were inclined to say, well, I'll do that on Monday, and they wouldn't do it on Monday or forget or get busy, all of a sudden now can go ahead and do it online, and so doing the right thing becomes the easy thing, and that's something that we really strive for.
Great, thank you.
Other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Oh, Representative Johnson.
Thanks. Thank you for being here today. Hey, just a question follows up kind of on Representative Richardson's line of thought, but I guess it pertains to the overall question is, how dynamic would you say your agency is in that the needs for oversight and regulation and consumer protection or whatever can vary with time?
Mm-hmm.
Representative Richardson gave an example of the mortgage industry that at one point in time was up here. A lot more participants, perhaps a lot more need for regulation. Economies change, things change, but is your agency prepared then to downsize, let's say, when those things occur? Or for my own business, the building trades business, obviously there were a lot more builders in the business asking for a lot more building permits back in 08 than there have been for the last couple of years. At the local level, to compensate for that, we've seen increases in fees and so forth to make up for that, because you have personnel, you have, you know, local offices and stuff that are built around a certain business model. Things change, they look for revenue to backfill with, and they're all fee driven. There is no general fund there and so forth. But as a mindset, do you see yourself as a dynamic agency that's capable of fluctuating and giving and taking and adjusting and modifying with economic pressures? Or are you, once we get an oversight in place, it's there and we'll be there come
I have a sense you're guiding me toward an answer.
Just wondering.
Thanks very much, Chair Holley, Representative Johnson. I absolutely think that we're a dynamic agency able to scale with the mission that's charged to us. A couple of things about that. If I were to have given this presentation 5 or 6 or 7 years ago, I'd be talking about the 1,200 people that do this work, not the 900 people that do this work. The building codes division is about a third smaller than it was at the in terms of numbers of positions at the peak of the construction boom. And so absolutely what we try to do is figure out how within these narrow slices and at some de minimis level, which becomes a problem when the slices are really small, but within those slices, figure out what's the most effective way we can staff and work to do that. I think the other thing I would say is that my philosophy since becoming director certainly has been a couple of fold. One is to really renew focus in the agency on our cost of doing business and find ways to drive that down, so that we've got more resource available to get on the ground to accomplish our mission. But then secondly, in this legislative session, recognize that the economy in Oregon is not such that this is a time for us to be growing programs, raising fees, trying to find new things to do. That's not to say that as problems emerge, we don't try to address them, but we have tried in every instance where we've got some kind of a discretionary choice to make it in terms of leaving things alone for the moment until the economy is much more stable, because industries right now, workers, I think benefit more from trying to get the economy back on its feet, and that's what we've tried to do in our approach to those issues.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I appreciate you coming forward and giving us a little overview today.
Thank you very much.
I think beneficial for us trying to understand your role and in what you do in the world of consumer protection. Thank you.
Thank you.
With that, our next presenter or presenters is from the Department of Justice, and they're going to give us a little overview of their role in terms of consumer protection. Ellen Rosenblum, Attorney General, Oregon Department of Justice.
Afternoon.
Welcome, and I think coming up with you or not is...
Yeah, Fred, is that okay if they
Fred,
join me up?
Absolutely.
Here?
Fred Boss.
Great.
And Ellen.
Thank you.
Coming up.
Very much, Chair Holvey. Ellen Clementon joining. We have the two Ellens here.
Yeah. Thank you. If you'd introduce yourself.
Yes, I am Ellen Rosenblum. I'm Oregon Attorney General. And seated with me, Fred Boss, the head of our Civil Enforcement Division at the Department of Justice. And to my right, Ellen Clem, who is our Consumer Education Outreach Coordinator. We also have with us this afternoon, seated in the back, Drew Leonopoulos, who is the head of our Consumer Protection Section of our Civil Enforcement Division, and our Chief Investigator, seated next to him, Jeff Darling.
Welcome, gentlemen, as well.
Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here before you. This is my very first appearance before a legislative committee as your Attorney General, so I'm very honored to be here.
And so are we.
Thank you, and I look forward to other opportunities as we work through a really important upcoming session. The first time that I appeared before, or actually I should say sat with and observed a committee at this in this building was when I was in law school and I was taking the legislative clinic, and I got assigned to a committee called the Senate Consumer and Business Affairs Committee that was chaired by then Senator Betty Roberts. So you can imagine that was a bit of time ago, but she then became one of my mentors, judicial mentors, as well as legislative. So I have really appreciated my grounding in consumer protection, and I am very honored to now be able to lead an agency where consumer protection is of the highest priority. As you know, we have, we have eight divisions at the Department of Justice. So one of them is the Civil Enforcement Division, and a part of that includes our consumer protection, our charitable activities, our Medicaid fraud unit, and the other civil enforcement aspects. And because of the breadth of what we do, and because I am still relatively new, I decided that it would be helpful to be flanked by two people. One is actually a little bit newer than myself, Ellen Clem, who is responsible for really getting out there around the state, traveling to do our preventive education outreach. And the work that she's already begun, I think, is going to pay off in terms of preventing the need for the kind of enforcement that thankfully we do have the ability to do. But we really emphasize at our Consumer Protection Division education and outreach in order to prevent consumer fraud. So I'm going to turn to our true expert and leader at the division, Fred Boss, to give you a little bit more of the detail of the work that we're doing in the consumer protection arena, and I'll also be happy to answer questions after Fred concludes his presentation.
Thank you.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, my name is Fred Boss. I am Chief Counsel of the Civil Enforcement Division at the Oregon Department of Justice. Thank you, Attorney General. I'd like to give you a brief overview of what we're doing at the Department of Justice concerning consumer protection. I've submitted written materials. I will, with great embarrassment, say that I noticed as I was sitting here a typo on the first page, and it says in the year 2000, it's the year 2012. So I hope you'll forgive me. It's been a rushed morning. I would like to always start out any presentation we have on consumer protection saying that our primary goal is education, both education of corporate entities, but also primarily education of the consumers. And to that to that extent, we think that that is exactly the primary and the most cost-effective method of preventing scams and of deterring unlawful activities. And so I'm really happy that Ellen is here, and we've passed out some materials for you that show what our consumer outreach materials are like. We Ellen Clem goes around the state visiting various groups, handing out materials. We also have moved into the, hopefully, 21st century, that we have a consumer database, a complaint database. It's online. Any consumer that's doing business with any business can look in with our, go online, check in the Attorney General's database, run the name of the business entity, and they will find all the consumer complaints that were made against that business entity. They can narrow it down by the exact store or geographic location. They can find out the exact nature of the complaints, whether they were just merely concerns or whatever. So we thought that that would be, especially in this modern era, to allow people to have a greater access to the knowledge that we have. We put this online. We make every attempt to keep that as up to date as possible, and I think we are within, say, 30 days or so have the relevant consumer complaints on there. Unfortunately, consumer outreach and education doesn't always work, and so we do take enforcement actions when we have to. And the mission statement, I think it's important to know the mission statement of our enforcement group, which is our Financial Fraud Consumer Protection Section. And that is to stop, deter, and punish unlawful conduct, and wherever possible, to shift the cost of enforcement to violators and to recover restitution for consumers. That is, in a nutshell, what we do. Mr. Allen alluded to, our primary tool is the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. I'd also like to focus on, and whenever possible, to shift the cost of enforcement to violators. Our consumer protection effort here in Oregon is 100% self-financed. We do take the enforcement. We do force the people that we take enforcement actions against to pay for the cost of the enforcement. So there are no general funds, there are no contributions from regulated industries. It is all financed by those who are committing wrongs. This last year was fairly eventful for us, and then one thing I did note in the written materials is that the foreclosure crisis has pretty much swept Oregon, and we in the Financial Fraud Consumer Protection Section were at the forefront in dealing with this crisis on a national level. We were engaged in the nationwide, multi-state settlement with the large five major mortgage servicers that brought over $300 million of relief to Oregon homeowners. We also, at the direction of the legislature, we helped assemble with our colleagues at the Oregon Housing Department a foreclosure avoidance mediation program in order to assist the mortgage servicers and the homeowners to work out a solution to foreclosure that is less than going through the actual foreclosure and hopefully less costly to Oregonians. Our trends, where consumer trends are trending upward. We have increased consumer complaints. We have increased searches on our database. We do have a phone bank manned by volunteers. It's called a consumer hotline. You'll see the materials in the number in the materials that we handed out. They attempt to work out to receive the consumer complaints. We hand them to the enforcement officers that attempt a first level try and negotiate a mediation between the consumers and the affected industries. I've noted in the written materials, the trends that we're seeing, and the consumer complaint categories. We usually name a top 10. I've listed here the top five. That's telemarketing calls, collection agencies, home ownership, telecommunication, and motor vehicle sales. These are based on the number of telephone calls we have into our consumer hotline, which kind of is a gauge of what is out there with Oregon consumers. Oregon, the Oregon Department of Justice is a leader in dealing with cases involving the pharmaceutical industry. And the pharmaceutical industry will often get into trouble with the way that they advertise various products and and the charges that they'll make. We have taken the lead role in that, and I've noted here a large settlement that we had with GlaxoSmithKline concerning the Avandia drug for $90 million for Oregon and 37 other states. This is a great example of how we do work in this area, because we don't work alone, and just one state by itself would have a difficult time dealing with an entity like SmithKline. What we do is we work together with our fellow states that might have an interest in a particular industry, and with the Federal Department of Justice, and share the burden of litigating or moving forward and negotiating with these large industries. That does increase leverage our efforts. It leverages the amount of influence we'd have on the negotiating table with these companies, and it's more cost effective for Oregon and getting better results for Oregon consumers. Attorney General Rosenblum, when she came into office, said that she has three primary goals for us and to focus on. We would like to help seniors. We want to help vulnerable, diverse communities. And we want to look into helping young people. So as we're looking through the complaints that are coming in and choosing our what we do, we're going to make sure that we have this focus in mind and move forward with what the Attorney General wants us to do. Not only do we have our Financial Fraud Consumer Protection Group, which does uses it as its primary tool the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. The Department of Justice also regulates charities in the state. In fact, the Attorney General is the primary regulator and enforcer for charitable organizations and in the state of Oregon. We protect charitable assets. We also take enforcement matters for improper solicitations, like the telemarketers for charities or for people knocking on the door when they may not actually seeking charitable solicitations when they may not be actually representing any particular charity. Of note, there is House Bill 2060 that will be in the legislative session this year. It focuses on reducing or eliminating the tax exemption for those charities that do not give or fail to give a certain amount of their proceeds to the charitable cause. I believe in House Bill 2060 that is a minimum of 30% to the charitable cause. So the what we had found through the years, unfortunately, is certain charitable solicitations will be financed or by a particular, I would call them telemarketing groups. They will seek solicitations and only give 0.5 of a percentage of the solicitations to the actual charitable organization, taking the remainder for themselves. The another area that we focus on in the Department of Justice for charitable, for consumer protection is our Medicaid Fraud Control Unit. This is a unit that is financed 75% by the federal government. It focuses on preventing fraud in the Medicaid system, when it focuses primarily on preventing the provider fraud. So when it receives a recovery of that, it gives it back to DHS in Oregon. It also focuses on physical and financial abuse of patients who are in long-term care facilities, and primarily it takes a prosecutorial role there and works with the local district attorneys in prosecuting cases of financial or physical abuse and then recovering those funds, if it is financial abuse, for the patients and for their families. One last area that we are involved in consumer protection is in regulation of the marketplace. We do use the state and federal antitrust laws to make sure that there is an even playing field for all companies. In addition, the Attorney General, and together with the Treasurer, does from time to time engage in securities litigation on behalf of OPERS, so the Oregon Public Employees Retirement System. And in taking a lead role in some of these securities cases, we do emphasize what is called corporate governance to make sure that the corporations that may be found to have violated the corporate securities laws do take those measures necessary within their corporation to make sure that they don't further engage in that type of activity. I'll be happy to answer any questions if you have any.
Thank you. I don't know if Ms. Klim was going to present at all or not.
I don't believe I was. Good. Basically, she's just getting up to speed and has lots of exciting projects underway, but probably not quite ready to report other than that she'll be doing that outreach in those three areas.
We'll open it up for questions if we have any from the committee. Ms. Lively.
Thank you very much for the presentation. So I have a question regarding these 40,000 calls. And my question deals with, so what's the expectation set with the person that calls of what's going to happen after they've made the call? That's a lot of calls.
Yeah. Thank you. Chair Holvey, Vice Chair Lively. The expectation... The calls have a wide variety of topics, and what I hope the expectation is that we will hear the caller and address their situation. And if they are calling because they have a specific problem with a specific store or whatever, then the volunteer will talk to the person, try to ascertain exactly what is the problem and who is it with, and then encourage them to go online and file a complaint with us. That complaint then comes in. We give it to an enforcement officer who then contacts the store and informs the business entity that there is a consumer out there that's unhappy because of this reason, and can we do anything about it to address this complaint? They work as kind of a mini mediation program and trying to work to get a resolution at the least cost level of the consumer's complaint. So I think, to go back in a rather circular manner to answer your question, I believe it's the primary expectation of a caller into the consumer hotline is either resolution of their conflict or some basic information. And then the consumer hotline folks are trained to say, once they ascertain the nature of the call, they can direct them to our website or to other websites to get the information.
And if I might just add that the two gentlemen that I introduced you to earlier, seated in the back, will meet every week to discuss which of those calls really ought to move further in the process in terms of enforcement. So our chief lawyer and our chief enforcement investigative officer work very closely together to ensure that if we do need to take action of a more formal nature, that we will do that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Vega Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, first of all, thank you so much for being here today. This is my first time asking a question on my committee, so it's a first for both of us.
Welcome.
And I had a question about an area that I'm interested in, which is for-profit colleges, and I was curious if you've seen, it kind of goes in line with the seniors and the young people and some of the areas that you're targeting, if you've had calls around that issue and if you've seen an increase in the past few years. when that issue is called.
Right, and that is an area that I'm very interested in. In fact, that is one of the reasons that I included young people, because by that, actually do mean including college students. In fact, in particular, college students who are saddled with a great deal of debt and who may or may not be in a position to pay that off, depending on whether the education they're receiving will get them to the point where they are, in fact, employable. And I think we perhaps Fred could add something to that in terms of the specific answer.
Chair Holvey, Representative Pearson. We have received consumer complaints against for-profit colleges, not an overwhelming amount. We have undertaken investigations of the various for-profit colleges that are here in the state of Oregon. And circling back to a securities litigation, we were the lead plaintiff in an action against Apollo Corporation, which is the holding company, I guess I would say, for Phoenix, and that's filed in the federal court in Arizona. So, and one of the reasons that we decided to take that role was to investigate the corporate governance and to maybe help them to alter their business model.
Other questions? Representative Thatcher.
Kind of jumping back to a previous question, I think Representative Lively was brought up about the 40,000 calls, and that is a lot of calls. Do you get any feedback or seek any feedback as to how satisfactorily these calls were resolved or not resolved, or at least you did all you could? I mean, do you get any feedback or seek it?
Chair Holvey, Representative Thatcher. We have informal feedback from letters from happy consumers. I don't think we have done a formal survey seeking the degree 1 to 10 satisfaction of the people who have called into the consumer hotline. That's a wonderful idea, and that would I think that maybe we can pursue looking into it and maybe help us fine-tune our services.
Other questions? Oh, Representative Doherty.
This is more a comment. I'd like to personally thank the Department of Justice. I have a few constituents who were facing foreclosure, and part of the foreclosure was I paid my mortgage payment, but the bank doesn't have a record of it. And thanks to the Department of Justice, two of those people are now out of foreclosure and long, but it was months and months before they got any satisfaction until we went to the DOJ. So I appreciate your help very much. The two gentlemen that were handling that area did a phenomenal job.
Thank you very much, Representative Doherty. And I'm aware of those two gentlemen, and they do a wonderful job for DOJ. Thank you. I might also add that I think Fred Boss mentioned earlier that volunteers are the ones who actually take these calls, and we have how many volunteers? Hundreds. It's incredible. I run into them all the time, and not only do they do a fantastic job, but they're very appreciative of the opportunity to help our consumers. So it's really an outreach effort, even right there in our offices, and I want to thank in particular Jeff and Drew for the way that they run that volunteer program. It's really quite impressive.
Thank you, Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How many staff do you have? What's your agency budget? Has it been growing or shrinking over time?
Right. Well, the total staff at DOJ is approximately 1,300. Some people are surprised to learn that almost half of that number work in our child support services area, which is something that some attorneys general's offices don't handle at all. But we do, and we're very proud of the work that we do in that area. But it is almost half of our employees. The other half are divided up among the other divisions, the other seven divisions of the Department of Justice. Our total biennial budget is $400 million approximately, and of course that includes general fund, other funds, and some federal grants as well. And of course we have our law firm, which is our general counsel division, which is responsible for bringing in a certain amount of revenue on a regular basis, and so that is why we are sometimes referred to as the largest law firm in the state.
I think I have a question for you as well. I would
like to first comment that I have turned in, I used the hotline and was quite pleasantly surprised that somebody answered the phone right away. And I was able to give them my complaint with the specifics that they wanted. And, you know, they did say that they'd heard a complaint on this particular practice or company before, or this phone number, actually, and logged it in, and, you know, with no, I guess, expectation that they'd ever be able to do that, but they were just amassing the information to, you know, pursue at some point. So I do appreciate that. But my question revolves around, the number one complaint are telemarketing calls. And my wife is always chastising me about what am I going to do about these unsolicited robocalls when we're on the do not call list. And they're largely coming from out of state. And I know that some of our agencies have also had problems over through business that's being done over the internet and businesses that's coming in from out of the state and actually making transactions with people that live in Oregon. But it's really a tough issue to figure out how to enforce. And I'm just curious if you have any great ideas on what we should do about all that.
Thank you, Chair Holvey. That is something that I have heard a number of times. The do not call list does not seem to be solving the problem. And I believe that we are referring people to the Federal Trade Commission when that happens. But let me consult with my expert here.
Chair Holvey, that is a challenge. And it used to be, not too many years ago, that most of the boiler rooms for these calls were out of Nevada or some other states, and that we were taking such such enforcement efforts that we would get the maps and they would say, do not call Oregon. The problem now is that they are not in Nevada, and they're overseas. They're in the Philippines or in China, and so it's very hard to have the long arm of Oregon reach out to Indonesia to tackle these telemarketers. But it is always number one, or usually number one. It is annoying, and it's something that we're constantly trying to address. But as we address one situation, they move to a different situation. So it's something that we constantly struggle with.
Thank you. Well, good luck on solving that. It'd make my life a little better. It has been a point of frustration. But the other part of my question was, for example, we passed legislation on debt settlement companies, and I know that you've taken some action in that arena, and I applaud you for that. We still have trouble with companies that are transacting that business from out of state, yet still within the United States, and trying to figure out what compels them to abide by Oregon's law when they're operating through the internet primarily or TV. Have you had any luck with that arena when you're talking to somebody out of state?
Chair Holvey, that is where we use the vehicle of the multi-states, and we get together. We're not unique in having these problems, and so we do get together with our colleagues in other attorneys general's offices and with our colleagues in the federal government and try and attack this situation.
Chair Holvey, I just returned from an attorney general conference, and when I returned, I asked my staff that would put together a list for me of the number of multi-state investigations that we have ongoing in the consumer protection arena, and there's about 3 to 4 pages worth of cases that are at least under consideration at this time. The attorneys general work very closely together, and it's something that I look forward to doing. Of course, we won't enter into every case, but it's certainly something that we can consider and that we talk about at these meetings. So I really wasn't aware of the extent of the ways in which we can work together to get more leverage and to really take advantage of each other's expertise and resources as well.
Thank you. Other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Thatcher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Before you leave, are you aware of what other states do for funding of, I think you referred to some investigative units that go out and kind of, you know, check into things, and if there's some wrongdoing, they're, you know, basically the wrongdoers are paying fees. Is that kind of the norm for
attorneys general across the United States, or?
Chair Holvey, Representative Thatcher. It varies by state. Ours is completely self-funded. Up till 10 years ago, we had a mix of general funds and self-funding. I think way a while ago, it was generally funded, and that's kind of what you see across the United States. You see a mixture of generally funded operations, operations that are mixed funding, and then a few like us that are primarily self-supporting.
Thank you. Representative Richardson.
That's referred to as eating what you kill, and it can be dangerous, because it's a conflict of interest in that if you're fully funded out of the proceeds that you can obtain from those that you're prosecuting, it can, unless you're very careful, of course, enter into concern or consideration on when you settle or when you don't, the amount of flesh that's required in order to get a settlement or to end the prosecution. And we know that you'd have the highest form of ethics, but we hope that you'll continue to be very cautious about not allowing the finances to enter into the consideration as to doing justice.
Thank you, Representative Richardson. We'll certainly take your words to heart. Yeah. Appreciate that.
I think that is a good point, but on the flip side, you know, I don't think the taxpayers want to pay for the investigations of somebody else's wrongdoing. It's a balance, I'm sure, like most of our government processes are. I really appreciate you coming to your first legislative committee, and I'm sure we'll see you back before this committee this session. So,
thank you, Chair Holvey.
Thank you so much, and have a pleasant day.
Thank you. If I might, I was remiss in not introducing Aaron Knott, our legislative director. I believe many of you have already met him, but if I might just make sure that he has the opportunity to say hello.
He looked like a familiar face.
Yes, indeed. Thank you so much for having us. We appreciate it, and we look forward to working with you.
So, committee, we have one more presentation, last and certainly not least, but we'll deal with the government, general government efficiency part of our committee. And it is the Department of Administrative Services, and we have Sarah Miller joined by Diane Lancaster, I believe, who is not on our agenda, but more than welcome to be here and talk about some specifics we'll be looking at.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, my name is Sarah Miller. I'm the Deputy Chief Operating Officer, and I work at the Department of Administrative Services. I have here with me today Diane Lancaster, who is the Chief Procurement Officer performs oversight of most of the state's procurement system. And because Chair Holvey asked us to give both a update of the changes that have happened at the Department of Administrative Services and kind of give you a public contracting 101, it seemed relevant to bring the Chief Procurement Guru with me, so thanks for your flexibility in our agenda. The Department of Administrative Services, unlike many state agencies, predominantly provides service only to state agencies, and so where most state agencies provide some kind of service direct to Oregonians, the Department of Administrative Service exists to service other state agencies. We have about 770 FTE and have about a $8 million general fund direct to us in our budget, and about $1 billion of total fund. It's important for you to understand that the total fund comes from other state agencies, many of which are general funded, and so we have a larger percentage of general fund dollars in our total budget, but we get about $8 million direct to us in general fund. So as a general overview, I wanted to talk about the mission of the agency. We exist to serve state government, to benefit the people of Oregon. Service is defined in our mission in the following four ways. We implement decisions of policymakers, both the legislature, the governor, and policy setters. We work consciously. My boss, Mike Jordan, the Chief Operating Officer, leads on behalf of the enterprise. And so the governor is very interested in us looking at the management of state government operations from a total enterprise perspective. And so our call and the work of the mission of the agency is to lead on behalf of the total suite of state agencies. We need to do a job to partner with our customers to achieve the outcomes that we need, and I'll talk a little bit about that in our service delivery lines. And then it's our obligation, your expectation, to deliver the best value for every dollar that we spend. And so service to us means ensuring that we do that. To fulfill that mission, we have organized ourselves into an organizational model that separates out our policy-related functions from our service delivery functions. Many of you know in the last regular session, House Bill 5502 passed, which was a direction to the department to implement a model we call entrepreneurial management. It was meant to take our service lines and make them more business-like in their operation. We decided that it was very difficult for our frontline folks to navigate the difference between enforcing statewide policy and the role that we have from an oversight and accountability perspective and providing direct service to our customers. And so we changed our organizational design to separate out the policy and oversight function from our service delivery. To the policy side of our organization, our goal is effective, high-quality leadership, governance, and oversight. So it's our job to make sure that the enterprise does what policymakers want for it to do from an operational perspective. From the service delivery side, it's our job to deliver to state government the right service at the right price at the right time and to make sure that we're agile and nimble in our service provision. But then agency-wide for us, we have a goal that the only way we can meet the other two goals is with a knowledgeable, skilled, diverse, and engaged workforce. So we took our executive team through a strategic planning process where for each of those goal areas, we set forth some specific strategies. If you've had the opportunity to hear my boss, Michael, speak to his view of managing the operations of state government, he talks a lot about operating from a place of shared leadership instead of, I think, the role that the DAS director has traditionally had, where as a former agency person, we used to joke about the DAS policeman. So it was their job to be the compliance enforcers, and Michael's view, the role of the chief operating officer is very much to implement a shared leadership model of governance. He also has asked us to review on a regular basis and aggressively work to advocate for effective policies and specifically to remove barriers. And so some of what you will hear us talk about as the session progresses is specific streamlining exercises that we've undertaken to make our policies more nimble to better serve state government operations. From a service perspective, entrepreneurial management for us was really about providing customers choices as much as possible, that we needed to build a funding structure that allowed for customers to pay for the services that they used, for them to be able to decide what level of service they wanted to get, and to have control of their budget from that perspective. And so part of what I'll share with you today is how we've changed the oversight portion of our service delivery organization. And then from an agency-wide perspective, we really had two goals. First, my boss requires we need to be in a culture of continuous improvement. I'm a project manager by training, and so I come to this job having regularly stood up, planned for, executed, implemented, and closed projects. And my boss likes that part of my personality because he thinks it helps us be in a continual state of challenging our administrative team to look continuously at ways to improve, not just to go through a single organizational structure and then be satisfied with the results. But, you know, you shouldn't be surprised by the goal that we set agency-wide. For us to be able to deliver services, we have to have employees who are the people on the front line who make sure that state agency needs are being met. And so our obligation from a management team perspective is to invest in our folks' development and make sure they have the skill sets that they need to be able to do their work. So our organization, I talked a little bit, was split from a policy and service perspective, and so this picture shows you our policy functions from a statewide perspective. So we have now a chief finance office, so most of you would know that as the former budget and management division that was the governor's budget officers, but we decided that it was important to integrate the budgeting work that we do with the statewide financial reporting work that we do, and so we brought the folks who do the annual state reporting into that office and have added then policy functions for statewide procurement. Diane works works in the Chief Finance Office, and also statewide facilities planning. And so we've really expanded the role to integrate the financial functions to not just be budget related, but to include implementation and execution from a policy perspective. The Department of Administrative Services has long had the Human Resource Service Division, which we now call the Chief HR Office. That group structurally has units that are responsible for development of statewide policies that result like from our collective bargaining agreements. That unit has folks who do executive recruitment, so we help agencies or the governor recruit agency directors. We also have folks in that shop who do statewide workforce development and labor relations and are responsible for the collective bargaining process on behalf of the governor. The next policy area that we have is the Chief Information Office. That has the state CIO. Some of you may know it formerly by its old name, Enterprise Information Security Strategy Policy Development Division, EISPD. We think state CIO is much clearer. It has three prime functions. We have folks who do oversight of major IT projects from a quality assurance perspective. We have folks in that shop who provide enterprise security information policies as it relates to how we protect and secure information assets. And then we have folks in that shop who provide geographic information services. So a bunch of the data mapping and applications that we have that take information from a lot of source systems and display it visually work in the state CIO office. Finally, I lead the statewide office, the statewide coordination office. I got that slide wrong. Inside of statewide coordination, we have the Office of Economic Analysis. So that is the state economist who does the revenue forecasting and methodology work. That office is also responsible for forecasting adult prison population beds, juvenile population beds, and does some cost allocation of highway fund dollars out of the trust account. Also inside of statewide coordination is the cross-agency coordination of legislative relations, of communications. We also have the statewide internal audit coordination, so we coordinate statewide internal audit services. And then we have a newly formed sort of enterprise project management and performance management office. And so that's a team of project managers who work on enterprise initiatives, which would cross a single agency boundary. So the 10-year plan for Oregon came out of that process. We've also done a project for counties in fiscal crisis. We supported the governor's effort on regulatory streamlining, all with project managers out of our statewide coordination office. So you might sit there and ask this question about why does it make sense to coordinate policy functions, and I think this is really the call. You know, I'm a firm believer that we need simple, straightforward policies that everyone can understand. My agency doesn't have a long history of doing that, and so we need to work to simplify policies. My boss believes that our job is to remove barriers to agencies' business operations while providing consistency for implementation, and so we find ourselves in an economic environment where we can't solve every problem agency by agency. We need to look at scalable solutions from a policy perspective and implement those. But I think mostly part of the innovative stuff of what we're doing now in terms of coordinating policy functions is trying to solve problems without creating formal policies. I think my organization has an institutional history of every time an issue got raised, we promulgated a statewide policy to tell people how they should react to it. And I think that my boss prefers a model of when an issue gets raised, if it has applicability, we have an enterprise level discussion about it and come to operating agreement without having to promulgate formal policy. And that really drives the second or the last bullet on that slide. It's not our job just to enforce compliance, but my boss would prefer, and shared leadership model would require, that we win it, that we work in partnership together to deliver the best value in the work that we do, and that people will willingly comply with what you require if we are doing our job right and making policies that make sense. So then if you transition to the service side of our organization, this is by far the largest from an FTE perspective, and these are the organizations that provide direct client service to state agencies. So we'll start first with enterprise HR services. So this is state agencies who are small, usually in FTE, who buy their HR service from us. So we run the whole process for them. We act as their recruiters. We do investigations. We maintain a consultative role to help agency directors deal with personnel issues. In that shop also is our maintenance of the state's HR system, and so the information system that provides information about all state employees, we call PPDB, is serviced inside of Enterprise HR Services. The next organization is Enterprise Technology Services. Some of you may know it in its past life as the State Data Center. In the separating out of policy and service, we took a fair number of direct services out of the office of the state CIO and moved them into Enterprise Technology Services because it shouldn't just be about the infrastructure from a technology perspective. So now the state's application development shop, so the programmers who actually work on programming statewide systems, work in Enterprise Technology Services. Our folks who provide direct client service support of help desks for agencies who don't have their own help desk function. In fact, we provide help desk support to the governor's office in this building. All those folks now work in a single technology organization so that we can integrate across the life cycle of technology, not just in a singular infrastructure perspective. Enterprise Goods and Services is our organization that provides all the other pieces and parts to state government. So that's where the state risk management program is and our self-insurance fund. That's where state publishing and distribution and the folks who do all the printing, all of our statewide financial systems, so the state's payroll system, the statewide financial management system that produces checks, all exist inside of Enterprise Goods and Services. And then the biggest change from a procurement perspective is we separated out the procurement oversight office from the folks who do procurement services, and procurement services is in Enterprise Goods and Services now. The last organization is Enterprise Asset Management, so those are our traditionally most people think automatically of facilities, and that's certainly the largest book of business in Enterprise Asset Management. But we also have our fleet management there, our parking management, and then our surplus organization. And so we've taken kind of the whole life cycle of asset and put those things together so that we can be thoughtful in our planning and management from a service delivery perspective. The last few slides that I have to share with you today really talk about the change in the governance of our service organizations. And so as part of implementation of entrepreneurial management, and we talk about giving customers choice, you know, my boss, right, who operates from a shared leadership perspective, says, I don't want to just give customers choice. I want to formalize the authority for them to have voice and choice. And so for each of our four enterprises, we've established a customer utility board. Imagine it like a board of directors of a utility service who provide feedback and do planning to help the enterprise service delivery function know what it should be doing. They're actually chaired by customers, so they each have formal charters that my boss has signed that give them specific authority, and the implementation is chaired by external customers. So for us, what the authority looks like, those are the folks who approve the rates that we set. So those of you who know the Department of Administrative Services know that we set a price list of services that then other state agencies have to buy from. Now our customer utility boards are involved in reviewing and establishing the rate setting methodologies for the service lines that we produce. They're responsible for approving general service level agreements, and so in each of our service lines, we're working towards having documented, this is the service you get for this rate. And so where there are places for there that there can be choices so that a customer can choose a different level of service, we articulate those in service level agreements. The utility boards are responsible for reviewing the business plans. So our enterprise administrators put together their best guess based on what the customers have indicated that they need on a go forward and build a business plan based on that. But we have dialogue then with our utility utility boards about, do those business plans make sense? Are they relevant to where we expect the industry is going? Equally then, they have responsibility to review our financial statements, right? So if we're doing our job from a business planning perspective and operating like you'd want a private sector business to run, you should be both involved in planning for the future and making sure that our actual delivery reconciles from a financial perspective. And then that's the place where if we can't escalate, or if we can't resolve service complaints direct with the customer, that those customers feel like they have a path to escalate to get service issues resolved if they feel like the administration of the enterprise is not addressing their concerns sufficiently. So that sort of gives you, you know, kind of the 15-minute flyby of what's different about our organization. I think the next few slides that we have, I want Diane to go through for you, which is sort of a big picture overview to public contracting, and I'm happy to take questions now about this and then contracting, or we can do them both at the end.
I think it would serve us best if we finish the presentation in light of the time.
Sure.
And
fair enough.
We're moving to something simple and easy to understand.
Right. Representative Holy, members of the committee, it's a pleasure to be here in front of you today. I've been asked to give you sort of a quick spin through the Oregon public contracting world, and I'm pleased to do this at the beginning of this session. For the record,
Diane, could you introduce
yourself?
Yes,
for the record, I am Diane Lancaster, the Chief Procurement Officer at the Department of Administrative Services. Thank you for reminding me. I've offered you a statement of what the goal of public procurement is, and I chose this statement partially because it is out of a university professor's article, and I think that highlights some of the increased interest and professionalism that public procurement is undergoing. Basically, this statement talks about best value. And this is also incorporated in the many chapter portions of the public procurement law here in Oregon. And the second part of the statement looks towards the service of long-term interests of the government, among those managing risk, both business and technical, accomplishing socioeconomic objectives, maximizing competition, and of course always, always maintaining the integrity of the procurement system. Some folks believe that the procurement code is very complex, and I actually heard a representative, I think last session, speak to that, who said it was the most complex part of Oregon code. I don't know, but it does seem to get pretty wiry. There are actually three parts to the code. I've offered a little help so that you can remember what they stand for. ORS 279A stands for all. That's where the definitions are and the generally overarching statements of policy and direction are contained. ORS 279B is for buying, and this is buying ordinary goods and services. This includes technology particularly, and I know information technology will be of great interest to you all as you work through your this session. ORS 279C stands for construction. That might be the easiest to remember. And in Oregon, the construction laws are of long standing, and many, many complex agreements, subtle kinds of instructions are included in it. Finally, there is one small piece of chapter that stands apart, and that is ORS 279-835, and there's a few other laws in there. This is the Products and Services of Disabled Individuals Program, commonly known as the QRF, or Qualified Rehabilitation Facilities Program. It stands aside because it is not technically under the code. It is a separate set-aside program. Now, I've offered you a handout, and I hope this takeaway will be of some service to you. On the first side of it, you'll see the public procurement system of Oregon, and I've tried to lay out a bit of a picture of the Oregon system. Basically, if you sort of start at that top left corner, and this is that handout that you have, you'll note that the code actually applies to all state and local agencies in Oregon. And this is an important concept. There are many states, Texas among them, who have several different codes for different groups of agencies. It becomes very complex, and I'm pleased that Oregon has chosen one code to fit all needs.
When you look to the right side of the page, you'll start to see the state agencies. And state agencies can be under DAS authority. They can be subject to our authority. And they can be subject to other independent authority. Agencies generally then fall either in or out of the code, and so there are some state agencies, like the lottery, who are actually outside the code and who do not follow the same rules. The university system is also outside the code. The agencies that have a mixture often find it challenging because they will have authority that flows from DAS and they have to follow our rules. They may have their own independent authority, and I think Department of Transportation is a good example of that, where they have independent authority to handle all highway construction, and so they have to make their own rules. Finally, at the bottom of this, there are certain requirements that are everyone is subject to. The minorities, women, and emerging small business programs, legal sufficiency reviews from the Department of Justice, and certain other laws that relate to sustainability of the economy and the environment are not contained in the actual procurement code, but are separate to it. I would point to the next slide, which just gives you a little hint that one statute in 279A says that DAS will conduct all procurements for state agencies unless those are delegated, or the Chapter 279A 050 applies. So there's a that's where you can find these exceptions that I've spoken about. And then next, there's a slide here about the methods. It is often misunderstood that Oregon procurements might be subject to a lowest bid concept. And many people have concern about that because they say, hey, we want to get best value. And certainly in the purchase of information technology, this is exceptionally true. So there are many methods actually contained in the code, and I put this slide in here mainly to show you that there are a variety of ways to accomplish procurements and public contracting, and they can, many different ways, requests for proposals, formal and informal, mix and match, different ways to achieve best value, and again, to meet those goals that ultimately we're charged with meeting. Finally, I've given you, on the flip side of that chart, the Oregon procurement preferences. I thought it would be handy for you to have a list, because this list is growing, and you, I'm sure, will be considering certain questions about preferences in public procurement work. There are two sections on the list. One is the top section, which gives required preferences, and the lower section talks about discretionary preferences. We've put the actual dates on your chart that you have in your handout so that you can kind of get a sense of the history of preferences in Oregon, starting with the requiring of purchases of state printing in 1959. And so we come forward, and there are some trends there. Lately, the legislative body has considered allowing agencies to prefer goods fabricated and processed entirely in Oregon or services performed entirely in Oregon. That was passed in 2011. So you can see something of the continuum of interest over the decades about what the legislature has been concerned with. And there is one executive order listed at the bottom of this preference sheet, which alludes to the governor's recent executive order on what we call sustainable purchasing or green chemistry. And I'm sure you'll be hearing and wanting to know more about that as you do your work. With that, I'll pause and be available for questions.
Committee, we have a few minutes left for questioning. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would it be possible to get more information on the CUB? And I don't even know which questions to ask, but I wouldn't want to use this committee's time, but if you could send to my office an overview of how that program works.
Sure,
Chair Holvey, Representative Smith, we'd be happy to do that. We have a one-pager that clearly outlines sort of how the process works from a governance perspective, what their scope of authority is. We can talk to you about how we put which kinds of customers on them and to make sure that they're represented for each enterprise. So certainly no problem.
That's so good. I'd appreciate the one sheet, but I also wear another hat.
Okay.
And that I chair the Budget Committee over General Government, which includes the DAS budget. And so I'd like to personally dig deeper into CUB.
Chair Holvey, Representative Smith, I'm the producer of the Ways and Means presentation, which will start in your committee next Monday. I can guarantee you we spend the better part of a 90-minute session talking about CUB, so we'll try to get you some information in advance. It's also our intention to bring a couple of CUB members so that you can ask them directly about their experience.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Chair.
I brought them here as a primer for you.
Thank you for that, Chair Holvey. I appreciate appreciate the opportunity.
Any other questions? Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for the presentation. And I was really interested when you said that there's going to be, you know, that you have an area that's focused on oversight and so forth, and especially with your background as a project manager, what we end up having is a legislature with oversight responsibilities, a very difficult time performing oversight because in one way, we've had to have like Paul Cummings down in LFO become a project manager to demand that there be quality assurance mm-hmm. and quality oversight and all of this before projects get funded, when in reality, it seems like DAS should be making sure that the various standards are being followed so that the legislature would just be doing oversight of DAS's close insurance to make sure that we don't have multi-million dollar fiascos. And so is there going to be a greater oversight by DAS in these multi-million dollar projects that you're over?
Chair Holvey, Representative Richardson, I appreciate the opportunity to respond because I think I want to acknowledge that we're very clear about the difference in the oversight that DAS would provide compared to the oversight that the legislature should and does provide. I think our approach from an enterprise perspective is to try to make sure that problems don't get solved individually. I think lots of times, particularly with IT projects, those happen inside of specific agency boundaries, and it's difficult to understand what's going on there, much less how you can scale that. I think our vision of a consolidated policy organization is that we should be connecting things. We shouldn't just promulgate particular information technology policy. We should consider the HR implications of that. We should consider the financial implications of that, right? And so we're doing a better job connecting the policy topics together so that we are creating solutions that are scalable across agency bounds. And, you know, certainly I think our intention is to refine our role. I think that my boss would prefer us not being in the scorecard of you're going to go to DAS jail if you violate a policy, but instead having policies be well-formed to meet business needs and to not get in the way of direct service delivery to Oregonians, but instead to ensure some accountability that can be passed on to ensure that we're giving you information on behalf of management of state government that you all can then do your appropriate oversight of. So I think it's a partnership. I think we're still figuring it out. I think that you will see in our subcommittee some more specific details about what we think it takes in terms of staffing to be able to do that in a more integrated way. And we'll speak very specifically to those possibilities with you.
Thank you.
Another question. Representative Kinnegar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to note, I don't think we got the handout. But
I was going to note that we seem to have not gotten the procurement handout in our OLIS system. Do we have it now?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we'll get it to you. We didn't have it out on the dais. But procurement's so simple that probably didn't really.
I'm sure Chair Holvey will be the only time you ask us to come and talk with you about procurement.
And it's a good point. I'd love to have you back as some of these issues are pretty pertinent to the policies
Certainly.
That end up getting implemented down in Ways and Means. And I think it's very helpful for this committee and the legislature in general to to learn and understand a little bit more about what DAS's functions are and how they deliver that best value to state agencies and the taxpayer.
Chair Holby, members of the committee, certainly as Deputy COO, you will see me often. I believe I'm actually on your agenda on Thursday to talk about a bill that we have. And, you know, my boss, Michael, and I will make ourselves available whenever you'd like to have those conversations.
Certainly. Any other questions? Not seeing any. I really appreciate you coming and giving us
appreciate the time.
A little kickoff for the session. And thank you very much. Committee, I appreciate your attention. As I promised, I told you that this would be both riveting, exciting, boring, and all those other things at the same time. And sitting through a long couple hours of presentation is definitely tests our attention capacities. So, but that's why we're here. And I appreciate everybody being here and paying attention. And look forward to seeing you at our next committee meeting coming on Thursday at 1 o'clock. So with that, I will adjourn the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Efficiency.